Good morning and welcome to a Monday on The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. You and I grew up with a pretty well fixed idea of what going to college was going to do for us, right?
Right. Absolutely. And that same idea has been perpetuated generationally.
Yeah.
And whether or not it's so true anymore, well, we've had some conversations about that. But you know that, you know, the path to linear success includes that dictum, go to college still, you know. And while it's true that some students go from high school to college to a better paying job in a nonstop journey, for many other students, it just continues to be a heft of debt they carry for at least a decade. According to the student loan resources company, studentloanhero.com, the average class of 2016 graduate now has $37,000 in debt. That's up 6% from 2015. But what about the part universities play in giving students less for more? It has a lot to do with the way public universities are funded and how they see their social missions, according to University of California, Santa Barbara professor Christopher Newfield. He details what he calls the great mistake. That's the title of his latest book. Professor Newfield joins us now in our studio. Thank you for making time for us.
Well, I'm very glad to be here.
Once America was thought to be just the center of great education, where many other countries would send their youth to be educated. And in some part, that idea still is out there, and yet it doesn't seem to be borne out by what we see in terms of rankings, of international rankings of countries. We're not even in the top 10 anymore. What happened to America's, you know, public university system that caused such a decline?
Well, they got more expensive, and they got for students, and they became more expensive for students because their public funding was being cut. Tuition was increased, and the only way that most students today can pay current levels of tuition is by taking out loans. And many people, especially in the lower half of the country by income, are naturally sort of loan averse because they don't have the family resources to pay them back easily. So many people just either stopped starting, or even worse, they would start, rack up serious debt, and then stop and not have a degree that they could use to try to pay the debt back, but they would still have to pay the debt back.
That goes to the mobility issue,
mm-hmm.
and we'll talk about that more in a moment. But in terms of how the universities began to move and change a social mission that used to be to put, you know, good people out into society, to make it very simple, and not necessarily make it a profitable institution, mm-hmm. except to be able to, you know, to pay what they had to pay to be able to bring in qualified teachers and to be able to have, you know, building physical plant in which to teach. That whole idea began to change into more of a business type model and a lot of partnerships with, you know, research organizations and whatnot to be able to focus attention there and not so much on the students. When did that happen?
Well, it happened gradually. It started in the 80s, and it's a little bit of the change in the larger social environment or political environment towards seeing business as great and the public sector as mediocre at best. And that universities started to internalize that view and started to see their more prestigious or more socially valuable activities as ones that were closer to the market that could possibly make money. You do not make money by doing high quality instruction for undergraduates. It's just the value of that goes to the individual and particularly to the society. The value does not come back to the institution in terms of returns on investment. So to the extent that society began to judge universities on return on investments and size of endowments and how much money you could make on technology transfer and that kind of thing, universities moved towards basically a private sector model for both generating revenue and evaluating themselves. And so that is the great mistake in the book's title. The great mistake is to think that you can do a public good with private sector structures. You can't do it. And so the book shows all of the negative consequences of trying to do that as we have been for the last 30 years.
Specifically, what would those negative consequences be that people might be able to easily identify?
Well, the first one is debt. You teach – when you raise tuition in a public university, you teach your legislature that you can get away – you can get along pretty well without – solid public funding. So there's a feedback loop. We usually assume, oh, they cut us and therefore we raise tuition. But it works the other way around over years. The legislature looks at a university like this one and says, oh, well, you guys can go to 10, 15,000 and we can cut you proportionately and then not restore it even when the economy gets better. And that's not going to hurt you because you can just charge your students. So that's, you know, that was a downward spiral in terms of needing then to charge students levels that then require them to take out debt. Another issue which is less well understood is research funding, because we do depend both economically and, you know, scientifically and in terms of arts and literature on, to a great extent, on our universities for new ideas, for innovations, et cetera. And we have gotten into a situation where we no longer expect the sponsors of those of research to pay the full costs. At one point, there was some cost sharing between states and the federal government that made that okay. Now the cost sharing is between the federal government and students who are paying so much more of the budget through tuition. And so basically the book is about the way that students are hurt by this, the way that research is hurt by this, and the way that university budgets are hurt by this. They're not made sustainable by finding private sector money. They're, in fact, made more fragile, more needy, more desperate. And the reason for that is that the gross revenues that come in from private sector activities are very different from the net revenues that the university is actually allowed to keep. So essentially, everybody's getting hurt in this process. And the book argues that we need to go back to a public good, or ahead really to a public good understanding of the university, fund it publicly on the understanding that the benefits go to society as a whole, and then fix the internal budgeting with a richer and deeper funding base that we would get from society and not just from students.
That's a very different mindset. And one that may be particularly thwarted by this administration and, you know, the ethos that it has brought. How do you see this moving forward when you're talking about issues of mobility that have already been undercut by accessibility to even mid-tier schools based on the debt issue, as well as the fact that you just have a lot of people kind of throwing up their hands and saying, I'm not even going to start, what you talked about a little earlier, this stopping of the starting?
Yeah, well, it's the Trump administration has made some commitments economically to the country, to his voters in particular. And he's said, I'm going to make America great again. And specifically, I'm going to make the American economy great again. And I'm going to make the American economy great for people who don't necessarily go to college. I think that's a huge opportunity, actually, for the public college and university sector to reach out to people that have been excluded and to address policymakers and say, if we are going to bring in a broader range of students, especially from family situations that are economically precarious, then we're going to have to get public funding to do that. So if, in other words, if Trump, who's a great privatizer and whose whole cabinet are sort of artists of using private money, public money in their private businesses. And, you know, this is something, of course, Betsy DeVos wants to do at the Department of Education, is take public money and support a expanded private and religious sector, right? I mean, this is their focus. You say, well, the only way that you're going to get your main goal, which is economic benefits, is by doing the opposite of what you say you want to do, that is going back to the public and allowing low-income, first-generation, working-class students to upgrade skills and to learn about, you know, the meaning of their lives as well, to learn how to, you know, be happy and fulfilled, to learn how to be happy and productive at the same time. If you lower the economic barriers by increasing the public side of it.
You wrote this book before we had the last election.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're looking at universities and saying, hello, you've got a really good opportunity here. Do you think that from what you have seen of the universities and the, how well-wedded they are to the model that they've been using now for quite some time, that they, in fact, will avail themselves of what you see as an opportunity?
Oh, it's going to take some time and lots of shows like this one. I mean, it's this model was installed not just since 2008, but since 1980. It's been a long time being developed. And, you know, lots of very dedicated and sincere people have devoted their lives to making it work. So it's the book is not about individual culpability or malfeasance. It's really about the way that extremely well-meaning people who are very effective in, you know, teaching and research and administration, and who want the best for their students and who want their universities to be great, are nonetheless trapped in a structure that doesn't allow those things to happen in the way that they want to. So I guess I'm avoiding your question, because in the short term, the answer is no. We're not going to change paradigms, but I think the changing paradigms will takes a decade. And all I'm saying about the Trump administration is that he has focused issues so starkly that we have an opportunity to do a rethink and to try some new things. My model is really a two-track where we keep doing what we're doing in order to maintain revenues and the structures that we have while setting timetables and goals to moving towards a more sustainable, more broadly based funding structure. So using some, for example, privately paid, you know, executive public policy programs to bring in high revenue so we can subsidize our master's students, which is what, for example, Berkeley is doing now. But then say, okay, in 5 years, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm not going to have a really expensive program for older people to subsidize poorer younger people. The state's going to step back in and do that subsidy, and so I can get rid of this program that exists mostly just to cross-subsidize. I'm going to just do what's educationally the most valuable, which I will be able to do by, say, 2021, 22, on this two-track model where the public side is fixed again.
Do you know of any university that's actually looking at that two-track model to be able to grow it over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I think people are feel scattered individuals here and there, everywhere that I speak. there is a sense that we've hit the wall with this. And some of the book is depressing reading in the sense that it's realist fiction. It's noir nonfiction about how this model is just economically not working. It's not just that it's ethically burdening students or unethically doing that. It's that it's not actually allowing universities to sustain themselves fiscally. So there's a big practical argument for doing what I'm suggesting of revitalizing the public side of this, because the mixed goals, it's too expensive for universities to sustain it, and we can't do it anymore.
We'll be looking forward to seeing who decides to take you up on your offer. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Christopher Newfield is a professor of literature and American studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His research in critical university studies links his concern with humanities teaching to the study of how higher education continues to be reshaped by industry and other economic forces. He's in Honolulu this week and will speak at UH Manoa. The book signing begins at 5 p.m., the lecture at 6 o'clock in the Art Auditorium.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, presenting Oahu-born singer-songwriter Blaine Asing in two sets, Wednesday, February 22nd. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Ever have this sneaking suspicion that things are on the verge of, I don't know,
how can we keep this thing stable? And no one's got an answer, which is a sense that actually, this thing that you call stable is actually rather scary and we don't like it.
How we convince ourselves that everything's fine, even when Rome may be burning. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, training young dancers of ALEI 2, but first, your backyard quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we thought about an important anniversary that came just a few days ago. On February 9, 2001, a Japanese fishing vessel lay about 9 nautical miles off the south coast of Oahu. It was a training ship for Japanese fishing vessels on a planned 74-day voyage to train high school students interested in pursuing careers as fishermen. 35 people were on board, 20 crew members, 13 students, 2 teachers. Students wanted to learn skills like longline tuna fishing, maritime navigation, marine engineering, oceanography. But on that same day, a U.S. Navy nuclear-powered attack submarine left Pearl Harbor on a cruise that was part of the Navy's Distinguished Visitor Embarkation Program, which took VIPs for rides on nuclear subs to show what the ships could do and build support for the Navy's nuclear fleet. 16 distinguished visitors were aboard the sub when it shot to the surface in what was called an emergency ballast blow-surfacing maneuver. The sub collided with the Japanese vessel, which sank within minutes. 9 crew members, 4 of them high school students, lost their lives. And this morning, we're looking for the name of the U.S. Navy nuclear sub. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer.
Good morning. I'm... Good morning. I'm Patrice Faderspiel from ArtOfAloha.com. You are listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Alvin Ailey formed his New York based modern dance company in the late 50s when African-American dance and music were seen as things separate from the world of modern dance, and the company broke barriers with every performance. In some ways, that's what his companies are still doing. The youngest dancers in the Ailey family perform in ALEI 2, which is touring the islands. Troy Powell is the artistic director, and we spoke with him about the company's legacy.
But I think with Ailey, we just perform with the most passionate humanity possible. I know in politics today there's so much going on, so we try to heal ourselves and take this opportunity as artists to, you know, try and get through all of the negativity and all of the refuge politics that's going on by through dance.
Well, in a way, that's a, you know, the whole idea of providing solace is in its way a reaction to current events. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, that was the whole idea of Mr. Ailey starting his company back in 1958, and he wanted to celebrate his African American heritage and the modern dance tradition. You know, and back then it was a movement. It was a statement. It was a social statement.
Sure.
That, you know, at that time there weren't very many opportunities for African Americans, but he wanted to celebrate, and that's what we're doing. We're celebrating through the bad blood.
Well, I remember the the early days of ALEI in New York, and its existence was a political statement.
Right. Exactly.
So I guess you don't have to overstate it when your very existence is a statement in some ways, yeah?
Yeah, the legacy is just so profound, and it's just so identifying that this is what ALEI is all about. But we're bringing a diverse rap. In Maui, which is, we're going to Honolulu, we're going to Kului, is that correct?
Kahului,
Kahului. And in Honolulu, we're bringing three works, one called Circular, one called Something Tangible, one called Sketches of Flames. In Kului, we're bringing four different works, In and Out, Gemiel, Something Tangible, Sketches of Flames. And in Waimea, we're bringing Circular, Stream of Consciousness, and Sketches of Flames. So we're doing new works as well as works that we've had in the rep for about a year. Now, which island is near Maui or in Maui?
Well, Kahului is Maui.
Right. Okay. Right.
Troy, one of the things you're going to like about this visit is the musicality of Hawaiian words and names. It might even give you some inspiration along those lines.
Yeah, of course.
But it sounds as if, well, you know, one thing I'm also thinking about is with a road company is, you know, how much can you pick up along the way in terms of the next project, the next idea, the next movement for a choreographer?
Well, we give each choreographer 3 hours a day for 3 weeks, and we invite three choreographers in a year. And we give our dancers a rehearsal period of 8.5 weeks. So during that time, which starts in July, we put it all together. It's like putting together a show, put together a tour with about, I want to say, 10 to 11 different works. And then we will travel on a 3 to 4 week tour for the fall and do those works, and then we'll have a winter spring tour and do those works, but we basically try to highlight the new works so that when we do our season, we'll have an evening of just new works as well as an evening of audience favorites, which are works that are returning into the rep from a previous year or so.
Well, one thing I just got to wondering about just now, Troy, was, you know, with a Broadway show, the first performances often get trimmed and altered based on responses. Do you do much of that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Each and every performance is different. Each and every performance is altered. Each and every performance has a different cast, which means it has a different story.
Sure.
Each dancer brings their own interpretation on their own story to the work, which I think is why Ailey is so alive and is so fresh, especially Ailey 2, which are these young dancers of the next generation sort of exploring their lives at this point. And they are experiencing their lives through dance, and they're experiencing dance based upon their lives.
Which is very much a jazz musician's sensibility, isn't it?
Exactly.
Kind of that to me was one of the innovations when Ailey came along, was bringing that kind of sensibility and that music to you know, formal dance concert presentation.
Yeah, what was so great about Mr. Ailey is he loved music, especially jazz.
Yeah.
He loved folk songs. He loved, of course, he loved gospel, spirituals. And jazz, blues, those were like his favorite works.
Which weren't necessarily material for, you know, a Broadway dance concert at the time. In fact, it was unheard of.
Right.
Using that kind of music in, you know, taking it to a town hall with a dance company. It was, you know, that was associated prior to that whole revolution with much more, quote, formal music. Yeah, but there's a definite link of those sensibilities, the jazz musician and the...
Exactly, yes.
Well, that keeps things fresh for you, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It really does. Every day is a new, fresh day. Every performance is, you know, there's a different expectation. Because that's performance, especially Ailey dancers. When we perform, we just... experience what we experience while performing. So whatever happens in the now at that time happens. And there are some magical things that happen on the stage because we have such great choreographers. We have such great rap. And, of course, our dancers are just very smart, phenomenal, passionate, and hungry. So there is no time to premeditate. You know, there's sometimes no time to be nervous. You just have to jump out there and expect the unexpected, which is the most exciting part about this performance.
I imagine, and stay hungry as well.
Yes, exactly.
Troy Powell is the artistic director of the Ailey 2 Dance Company, which performs in Honolulu at the Blaisdell Concert Hall tomorrow evening, in Maui's Castle Theater Thursday, and in Kamuela at the Kahilu Theater on Friday. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Hey, it's Peter Sagal of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Valentine's Day is coming up, and of course, the traditional way to celebrate is with format changes. So on HPR, starting on Valentine's Day, there will be new lineups on two distinctly formatted stations to bring you more of what you, wait for it, love. See, it's a tie-in. There's more news and more music. You'll find our show, Wait, Wait, along with other entertainment programs on HPR1. Find more information at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, featuring music by Mozart and Schubert. Joseph Swenson performs and conducts 7:30 p.m. this Saturday and 4 p.m. Sunday at the Blaisdell. More at hisymphony.org.
Not enough capacity is the bottom line following a pitch to Congress by top military officials. Is the U.S. really unready to answer the call? Civil Bee reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
The idea that somehow our military is not well trained, that we don't have equipment that's truly functional, that we have enough to be able to replace and augment, is particularly scary for Hawaii, because we kind of got a lesson in all of this last year when we found out that equipment and training shortfalls were responsible for that accident that killed 12 Marines off Oahu a little better than a year ago. So for us, this is particularly telling and really comes home. What did we hear from those top officials in Washington last week?
Well, this comes from Kirsten Downey, who is our reporter in D.C., and she went to these hearings, and sure enough, leaders of the Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marines were very blunt with Congress. They said, look, our military, it's overstretched. It needs more money. It's, in fact, verging on breakdown. They described airplanes that can't fly, ships that can't be deployed at sea, shortfalls in critical parts, all sorts of things, and one person said some of the equipment dates to the Reagan era. I mean, can you believe that? That's, what, 30 years or so or more. And that because of this, the U.S. is going to be constricted in terms of its ability to fight globally in multiple conflicts. It can handle small countries, but not so-called high-end adversaries. And in this case, we mean China and Russia. So it was a very sobering message for the Congress.
The idea that the dominance that we've seen in all areas of the military for such a long time maybe has made people complacent. Is this part of the message? Although we clearly saw that the military was being sliced and diced over several years, and maybe this is the result.
The blame really is can be shared by a number of people. Certainly, there are those in the Trump administration that are angry at the Obama administration, and that's one reason Trump has called for more money for the military. But in fact, it's Congress that really is mostly to blame. For the last 9 years, it hasn't been able to really pass a budget on time. Instead, it keeps passing what are known as CRs, continuing resolutions, and just kind of keeps pushing things back. That doesn't really allow for proper financial planning, particularly when it comes to the military. So you had folks like John McCain, Jim Inhofe, others, Meiji Hirono was part of the hearings, acknowledging that a lot of the blame is partisanship and gridlock in Congress. Whether they're getting the message now to change that, we'll see. As you know, the Republicans control both the House and the Senate and the administration.
Meiji Hirono is a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Has she been particularly vocal about this? I mean, we don't hear a lot from her on occasion. We do hear something that's particularly telling. Is this something that she's now taking up?
She is. It's something that she is concerned about. I should say that both she and Senator Schatz, as well as Colleen Hanabusa in the House, are particularly worried about Pearl Harbor and the workers in that area, which is defense-related. But yes, it's fair to say it's a priority given the economic necessity. Next to tourism, it's really the military in terms of money here.
An idea that we should understand and perhaps promulgate a little bit more than we do. Thank you, Chad.
Happy to do that another day.
All right. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon. Chad
Thanks.
Blair joins us with a reality check from Civilbeat.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And, Kathy, there are all kinds of reasons why people eat or don't eat, not all of them having to do with nutrition, yeah?
Well, that's what we're going to talk about today. You know, a lot of times people don't realize how common eating disorders are, and they think that it's just in young girls and that it doesn't affect men or it doesn't affect boys and doesn't last throughout a lifetime. We're going to dispel some of those myths today when we talk with an expert about different types of eating disorders and what people can do to recognize them in their loved ones.
You can have an eating disorder that lasts throughout your life?
Of course you can. You know, just like people who might be in a situation where they recover from other illnesses, you could, under certain circumstances, still revert back to those tendencies, depending on what started the process to begin with. Mm-hmm. There really is a lot of brain chemistry around this. And as we learn more about how the brain really does dictate behavior, we see that, in fact, if it's a biochemical issue for some individuals, that may be something hard for them to overcome. But there are ways to do it.
So some of these tendencies can be reversed with treatment, I would think.
Well, and that's what we're going to talk about is, you know, what would be the warning signs that somebody's suffering from this? And then also, are there any triggers that could get them back into that situation later so that we can make sure that they continue with recovery and not wind up going back to previous behaviors?
When you say triggers, it makes you think of a relationship to other kinds of addiction, yeah?
And we're going to talk all about it today.
I bet. Thanks a lot, Kathy.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
Aloha. I'm Tadbit Nasty from Pacific Roller Derby. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HI Conversation.
Stargazer Time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our very tiny planet, also what we can look for in our dark island skies. And as usual, we turn to the expertise of Christopher Phillips. Hey, Christopher, welcome back.
Hey, Dave, it's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Venus and Mars in our evening skies. Both will be in the southwest around 7 p.m., and both of them will set around about 9 p.m. Now, the moon this week is beginning to wane and will pass through its last quarter phase towards the end of the week, so our skies should get a little bit darker.
We are learning this week about an exciting new proposal to do a rover on a planet in our solar system, and it's not Mars.
That's right, yeah. Recently on Stargazer, we covered a proposed mission to send a drone to the planet Venus. This drone would cruise through the Venusian skies and send back data on the atmosphere of Venus. But the folks at NASA are thinking one giant leap further. NASA has been testing technology that would allow us to land a rover on the surface.
Is this something that the Russians tried to do decades ago?
They did, with the Venera series of landers, two of which were able to successfully touch down on Venus. However, these landers were massively over-engineered, and the brutal conditions on the surface meant that they didn't last long at all. In fact, they have probably corroded into flakes of acid-eaten metal since then.
And what makes NASA think they've got the technology to make it work this time?
Well, as you know, 1967 was a long time ago. Technology has moved on leaps and bounds since then. The brains at NASA have been testing electronics that can survive the harsh conditions on Venus and produce meaningful science in their time on the surface.
What kind of testing is involved with this?
Well, they're using a really cool piece of kit called the Glenn Extreme Environments Rig, or GEER for short. This is a test chamber that can mimic the conditions on every planet in the solar system.
Wow.
You want to simulate crushing pressures, corrosive chemicals, and the super high temperatures of Venus? No problem. The GEER chamber does it all.
And where is that?
Well, it's located at the Glenn Research Center in Cleveland, Ohio.
Wow, that's amazing. Quite an apparatus. Not something you'd want to get stuck in, that's for sure.
Definitely not.
And so how'd the technology do in the GEER chamber?
Very well indeed. In fact, you could say it has defied expectations. The components they tested were able to survive the simulated Venusian conditions for over 500 hours.
I like it. And another exciting Stargazer. Thank you, Christopher Phillips.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week.
Support for Stargazer comes from Urgent Care Hawaii, walk-in clinics in Pearl City, Kailua, Kapolei, and Waikiki, providing employers with occupational medicine and workers' compensation services. Letter UCareHI.com.
And now we're going to get back to our backyard quiz. Today we remembered the day in February 2001 when a U.S. nuclear sub off the southern coast of Oahu collided with a Japanese training vessel, the Ihime Maru. It had 35 souls aboard, and nine of them lost their lives when the sub performed an emergency ballast blow surfacing maneuver that brought it to the surface at a sharp angle and at a high rate of speed. The sub was on a public relations cruise designated to demonstrate its capabilities. In the aftermath of the collision, the Navy disclosed that such PR missions often allowed VIP visitors to take control of the sub as it shot to the surface. On this particular mission, 16 VIPs were on board, 14 CEOs, and a sports writer and his wife. The business executives were in the islands to raise funds to restore the battleship USS Missouri, the fabled surrender ship of the Second World War. Then President George W. Bush apologized on national television for the disaster, saying, quote, "I want to reiterate what I said to the Prime Minister of Japan. I am deeply sorry about the accident that took place. Our nation is sorry. We asked you to name the submarine. It was the USS Greenville."
And Beth Ann Dane Alani of Kona on the Big Island knew the answer. Congratulations. And that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, partnering with parents and educators in Hawaii to strengthen the connection between school and home with tools to help monitor students' gains. Achieve3000.com.
When Paramount Pictures went to Kauai to film Elvis Presley's Blue Hawaii, a great deal was at stake for the island, for Hawaii tourism, and for the hotel where the king and his crew would be staying. What would have happened if a very inconvenient murder had gotten in the way? That's the premise of David Penhallow Scott's new novel, Murder at the Coco Palms Hotel. A few days before Blue Hawaii's cameras are set to roll, a body is found, and the need to solve it is urgent in the extreme. David is on the line with a preview of his whodunit. Good morning, David.
Hey, good morning, Chris. How are you?
All right. Did that more or less set the stage of
Agatha Christie murder mystery
Yeah.
With a surprise ending, I hope, that you don't know who the killer is till the very end.
Well, I hope not.
And I use real people. And Mrs. Gethland, Miss Busher at the time, becomes a Miss Marple. And she has to solve the crime, or else she feels Paramount won't come in with the Elvis Presley movie.
Well, and it's likely they wouldn't, right? Nobody likes a murder in their publicity packet. What gave you the idea? I like the whole idea of, you know, I like the whole idea of the Agatha Christie structure that you've got.
Well, I've always liked Agatha Christie movies, you know, the Poirot and the Miss Marples. And so the structure there, but also you will get a real sense of how Coco Ponds was run. The magic that was created there at Coco Ponds is also in the story.
This is kind of the...
Some of the characters, it's a fictional story, I have to remember. Some people said, did it really happen? No. It's all in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I use these characters that come from Hollywood. Not the Blue Hawaii people, but these characters from Hollywood who hate each other, and one is killed in the middle of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a famous movie star, like a Gloria Swanson or a Lana Turner, and so Grace has to solve this mystery. The unfortunate thing is that I have this character, Percy, who is hired by her, and he is the most annoying character I have ever written. And he tries to get in the way, and does.
David, is it fun to write an annoying character? I bet it is.
Yes, it is. It's all the things I ever wanted to do as a kid.
Exactly. How does he annoy?
Well, he thinks he knows everything. He thinks he knows who the killer is, and he just messes it up. And he thinks he knows it better than Miss Busher or Miss Guslander, and he's almost going to get killed himself, being such a nosy busybody.
These days, and there have been a couple of Agatha Christie productions coming our way lately, and for several generations, all you have to do is say this is an Agatha Christie-style mystery, and people know what you mean. Do you think that's still true for the newer generations?
Well, for the readers, I believe it is.
Uh-huh.
But I also said PBS, I mean, certainly they have promoted the Poirot and the Miss Marple story, so I think I still think it's there. I still think the structure is there. We have kind of a different CIA kind of mysteries now and action.
Right.
But I still think the Agatha Christie form still works. Because everybody, of course, my big thing, as I said, don't go to the end of the book. You wait until see if you can discover who the killer is.
Sure, sure.
And most of the people that have been to Coco Palms, the former guests that I've sent books to, love it because it brings back Coco Palms. But the only one person had an inkling who the killer was.
That's pretty good. Well, because you have to drop all kinds of red herrings into this
of
story,
of
don't they?
Of course, of course. And the butler did it, of course.
Well, you know, one of the wonderful things about that type of mystery, one thing is they're kind of innocent. You know, the murder is not too grisly. It's kind of an abstraction.
Right, it is. It is.
And everybody is layered. So, you know, the guy who takes your bags up to the room has a sinister air about him, right?
Right, of course. Of course. And, of course, Percy could be the killer.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that yet.
I wouldn't dream of having you say that. But how do you manage to make, you know, a bunch of suspicious people plausible in that kind of context, David?
Because of the characters themselves. They were the worst types of Hollywood that have come in. So this woman was one of the megastars in Hollywood. And she's invited all these people for her birthday party who she hates and hate her. That was the premise. So it was easy. It was easy. Everyone had a motive to kill her and another person in the party. They all had motives, strong motives.
Well, it sort of, when you put it in a backbiting world like Hollywood movies, instantly everybody becomes suspicious, don't they?
Of course, and they should have been.
It reminds me of the Harry Cohn's funeral, the movie mogul's funeral, where thousands of people turned out, and Billy Wilder, the director, said, it just goes to show that you give the people what they want, right?
I remember that. I mean, Yeah, and he was a tough guy. Harry Cohn was a tough guy. He had many enemies.
Well, that's what I mean. It's really easy to imagine movie folks. And what year is this, David?
This is just before 1960. That's when Blue Hawaii came to film at Coco Palms.
So this
and
is kind of
a huge coup for Coco Palms. Just think of the publicity. Elvis Presley.
Oh, yeah, in his heyday.
In his heyday, absolutely.
Well, and also, these are very glamorous times for Hawaii tourism, aren't they?
Right, and I worked at Coco Palms at that time.
Oh, did you? Perfect. So we can expect plenty of period atmosphere.
Oh, lots of period atmosphere. And I only put the real names of people that I know are dead, and the rest are fictitional names.
And I assume they're all innocent, David.
Never assume.
It really sounds as if you had a lot of fun putting this together, David.
I did, and I learned a lot. I've moved to the Big Island because my sister Marion Penhollow lives here now, and I wanted to be close to family. And I've joined a mystery writers group, and they're wonderful writers.
Oh, that's great. Well, we'll want to continue to hear about your projects. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, can I add one thing?
We've got to go, but I see.
Got to go. Okay, thank you.
David Penhollow Scott is the author of Murder at the Coco Palms Hotel. He'll be reading from his new novel, Saturday at 11 a.m. at the Kauai Museum, and you can find out more about him and his books on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting dance company Ailey 2, performing works by today's emerging choreographers, 7:30 p.m. this Thursday in Castle Theater, mauiarts.org.
HPR presents a rare evening of chamber music with an unusual combo of harp, piano, and soprano in the Atherton Studio on February 18th at 7:30. Harpist Megan Bledsoe Ward has found duos and trios that span the classical repertoire to the contemporary avant-garde. Reserve your seats at hprtickets.org or by calling 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Hi, this is Jason Taglianetti, HPR's Multimedia Production Manager. My go-to programs are the TED Radio Hour and This American Life. If you have programs you gotta listen to, let us help you find them on our two newly formatted stations starting February 14th. We'd love to tell you about some new programs you might enjoy as well. Call us during business hours at 955-8821 or find schedules and more online on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Beth Ann, for 6 years now we've been waking up well before the crack of dawn, and I'm thinking seriously of some sort of ritual destruction of my alarm clock to celebrate the fact we don't have to get up so early anymore.
Well, we're going to see if that really helps her, whether your circadian rhythm is just
pretty much
tied into getting up at dark 30.
It's a terrible thought, isn't it?
Well, we'll just have to empirically prove it tomorrow, won't
That's
we?
Right. That's right.
Well, we're going to hope that you're going to plan to join us tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock when the conversation moves into its new time slot. And on tomorrow's agenda, we're going to start out our checking in with county councils around the state. First up, Kauai County Council Chair Mel Raposo.
And guitarists Eric Peterson and Stephen Inglis are going to share their new music live in our studio tomorrow.
And no matter what time we are on the air, you can always join the conversation via our talkback line. That number is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can still post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, tweet us at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR. And if you do call us on the talkback line, please be sure to leave your name and the town from which you are calling us.
And if you missed any of this show or want to hear recordings of our past shows, you can find them on the Conversation page, along with links to more information about guests and the topics we discuss on the show. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich, and we will meet you on HPR 1 tomorrow morning at 11 with more of the Conversation. See you then.